Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Heather Conley. I'm Senior Fellow and Director of the Europe Program here at CSIS. Happy Friday. We're delighted that you are here with us, and more delighted that we have such a good friend of CSIS with us today, Gordon Bonnyai, former Prime Minister of Hungary from 2009 to 2010. Even though that's the most prestigious title you can have, the title that I'm most proud of is Gordon's title of CSIS Senior Advisor. And I have been so privileged, and the Europe Program has been so privileged to hear the sage advice and counsel from Minister Bonnyai over the last 2 years as some extraordinary developments have occurred in Europe the last 3.5 years. Gordon has agreed to come and have a conversation with us about the European sovereign debt crisis, what it means politically, economically, and socially, the dynamics within Central Europe per se, but across Europe. And I could not think of a more timely moment as yesterday the European Central Bank President Mario Draghi continued to downgrade Europe's economic growth for 2013. The German Bundestag today decreased German economic activity for next year. So we know we're in for a long slog in Europe, which will certainly complicate the politics and the economics. By way of a very brief introduction, of course, from 2009 to 2010, Minister Bonnyai was Prime Minister. He's also served as the Minister of Economy and National Development, as well as the Minister of Local Governments and Regional Development in the Hungarian government. Previous to his government service, he was in the private sector with, as deputy CEO of Kredinstalt Investment Bank, and he also was the CEO of a leading Hungarian private investment group from 2000 to 2006. His new adventure post-government life is to head an exciting NGO in Hungary, the Progress Patriotism and Progress NGO, of which we have been delighted to be a collaborating partner with them. Minister Bonnyai is going to give us some framing remarks, and then we're going to walk back over and begin a conversation on the European debt crisis, and then we hope you'll join that conversation. And again, thank you for spending your Friday afternoon with us at CSIS, and please join me in welcoming Gordon Bonnyai.
Or I can just speak louder. Well, so thank you very much for coming by Friday afternoon to talk about Europe. And talking about what is happening in Europe in the recent years, I always remember that when I started to study in 1986 at the Karl Marx University of Economics in Budapest, the introductory subject to that was political economy. And when I finished my studies in 91, it was already called the Budapest University of Economics. And we were studying economic policy. And we saw that for the rest of our lives, we only need to focus on economic policy. And with this crisis, I keep remembering those teachings of political economy overruling economic policy. And probably that gives us an alternative approach to understanding what and why is happening in Europe. I think political economy is back with a vengeance. Political economy is back with vengeance, and what I'm trying to do in the next 10-12 minutes is to explain to you why I believe that what is on the mind of political leaders these days in Europe, as I had a short experience in that one. First of all, I think they have 5 key risks that they look ahead long term that are coming partly from this crisis, and some of them have started before the crisis. Number one is that post-crisis, we believe that the level of growth in the developed world, but in particular in Europe, will be substantially smaller than before. And if there is less growth, then there is less money to redistribute or less money to keep sort of social peace and prosperity. That's a significant challenge. The second major risk out of this crisis is reverse mobility, social mobility. Because in the last few decades, tens of millions in Europe have come from the status of being poor to lower middle class with the help of two factors, cheap loans and new jobs. And these two factors are the ones that are quickly gone with the crisis. And there is a serious risk, as we experience, especially in southern Europe, that masses who consider themselves to be lower middle class are slipping back to poor. One historian said once that revolutions are not made by those who are poor, but by those who get disappointed. And that is the biggest risk to our social stability in Europe at the moment. The third such item is coming from the fact that this crisis has not changed the already existing trends, but it has accelerated the consequences significantly. And one such consequence is the potential for intergenerational conflicts in an aging Europe. Less and less people will have to sustain more and more inactive retired people. And that is a danger that Europe knew well before the crisis that it's going to come, but we have much less time to deal with that. And politically, this is extremely sensitive. The fourth such risk is the emergence of isms. At times of crisis, protectionism is usually the first gut reaction of societies or countries to react on the crisis. But protectionism is just the anteroom to nationalism. And nationalism can quickly escalate into more violent forms of isms, like in the 1930s we have experienced those. So that's a major risk if we cannot manage our societies, especially in the countries where the original accumulation of democratic capital, to use a Marxist term, democratic capital has not gone far enough. It is easy to return under the pressures of the social pressures of such a crisis. This is a major risk. And the fifth item that is on the mind of leaders in Europe is what do we do about global rebalancing? How is Europe going to fare in the face of the emerging China, India, Brazil, and others? If we study history, a region or a country's economic performance cannot go separate ways long-term from its military and diplomatic influence. If the economic significance of Europe is diminished significantly and trend-wise, then its global clout and its global ability to represent its interest will also suffer. That seems to be an inevitable trend, but the pace and the sort of the end result of that trend will make quite a difference for Europe. Now, with this in mind, today decision makers in Europe have to face two urgent needs. One is how do we get rid of the mountains of debt and deficit that we have amassed as a result of first reactions to the crisis. Second, that Europe has a major competitiveness problem, unlike the US. The US has the first problem, but doesn't have the second. Europe has a major competitiveness issue, which can only be dealt with via structural reforms. So politicians, almost without exception, everywhere in Europe, have to do two things at the level of the nation state at the same time. One, to reduce costs, to cut costs or introduce austerity or increase taxes. So one answer is austerity, the other one is structural reform. These terms may be nice for a technocrat economist, but for politicians this means asking money back from the voters and asking voters to change the way they live. These are the two things voters hate most. So that is naturally bringing about a strong potential for continued political crisis. At the level of the states, the nation states in Europe, we will see politicians in the coming years, political instability in the form of politicians changing their mind quicker than normally they do, emergence of new parties, strange coalitions being formed, coalitions falling apart, and early elections, street demonstrations.
Since the onset of this crisis, around 17 or 18 governments have been changed in Europe out of 27. So this is pretty far-reaching. So there is a strong political dilemma in each and every country. Jean-Claude Juncker had phrased this dilemma very clearly when he said, we all know what we need to do. What we don't know is how to get reelected if we do what we need to do. And this is the classic political economy dilemma. Now, this is at the nation state level. And decisions in Europe are still and now more strongly than before the crisis are made by the national governments. But there is also another sort of political economy crisis at the EU level, the sort of common level. This crisis is showing everyone his own missed homework. And Europe's missed homework is a half-hearted, half-finished, half-explained integration. Europe, by nature, can only make decisions under the pressures of the crisis. Usually it's easy for political leaders to agree on popular things, for example, introducing a common currency as a symbol of European Union, but it was very difficult to agree on fiscal union because it's politically extremely difficult, and I'm going to explain now why. Fiscal policy, just think about it, what it means. Fiscal policy is the heart of every politics. It's not a technocratic thing. Fiscal policy is about how much money we take from one group in the society and how much money we give to another group in the society. This is the heart of politics. That's why the budget is always the ultimate vote of confidence in a parliament. So if the solution to Europe's problem is more integration, which requires a fiscal union and the banking union, that means that the ultimate, most important political decision will go up increasingly to the Brussels level. But if that happens, that will immediately create the next crisis, a political legitimacy crisis. It is the Greek voters who experienced first the dilemma which will soon spread to other countries. I would call it the T-model dilemma. The Greek voters are now experiencing the wisdom of Henry Ford, who said you can have the Ford T model in any color as long as it's black. And this is the same is true for Greek voters. You can vote for any government as long as they perform the program of the EU Troika. And this is very quickly showing the limits to democratic sovereignty on the nation of a nation state, which is under the umbrella of a larger monetary union. And this is what fiscal policy would mean for each and every country, not at such an extreme level than in Greece, but still the dilemma is there for everyone. So the next crisis of Europe after solving this, if solving this, is going to be a political legitimacy crisis. And that's why in Europe that leaders are talking about if there is a fiscal union, there is a need for a political union. Now, what is happening in Europe these days is that the two most important actors that influence politics, voters and markets, have at the same time realized that if they want solutions to their problems in Europe, it's not enough to go to the national capital, they have to go to Brussels. Europe was a relatively hidden technocratic project for 60 years, and now voters and markets realize that integration has gone far enough that they have to find a solution in Brussels, but it didn't go far enough that Brussels can provide a solution. And that is why what we see these days is, according to markets, an extremely slow and painful adjustment to their needs. But if you look at how quickly Europe can act, this is an unprecedentedly fast adjustment to the demands of markets. There was a fund manager who said once that events in this crisis can move from the impossible to the inevitable without ever stopping at probable. And that's what is happening in Europe. All those measures, all those institutions, all those new
rules would have been unthinkable 3 or 4 years ago.
So in this respect, it's very fast for the way Europe works, but markets still pushing it further and further into with their integration demand. Now, voters are coming just slightly behind markets and realizing this problem, and they want more say in what is happening in Europe. Hence the proposal that is coming, expected to come to the Council of Europe, the European Council next week at the next summit in Brussels from President Van Rompuy about the future of the European Union, which will include a narrative about, or a plan about fiscal union, banking union, economic policy union, or I would call it reform union, and political union. I expect that this proposal will be extended to three phases, an 18 months from now to 18 months will first phase, then an 18 months to 5 years, and beyond 5 years. So it will be a staged plan, as we expect. We don't know what's in that, but that's what we expect. But this plan, we have said it many times, but we may will consider retrospectively the December meeting as a historic one, in the sense of a launch of a next phase of integration in the history of the European Union. It will raise many questions. Some countries want to be part of a stronger integration. Some countries don't. Countries which are not members of the Eurozone will have to make up their mind. The easiest solution, don't forget, Europe is always going for the politically easier solution, will be probably a two-speed development. But if that happens, those who stay in the second speed have to make sure that it's not the reverse gear, because that could unfold the integration. It's a very dangerous, untested idea. Most likely, it is going to be a muddling through solution. That's what Europe knows and manages best. And there will be new institutions introduced that will not make Europe a federation like the United States, but on certain issues, countries will behave like federations. Banking union or certain fiscal issues without actually creating a classic federation like in the US 200 years ago. It is often compared to the United States, and when people look at Europe from here, they often ask the question, why is Europe not working like the United States of America? But there are completely different historic grounds. And people in the US, analysts in the US often forget that it took 100 years and the Civil War for the United States to become a properly functioning federation, and the central bank came even later. So in this respect, it's a very different kind of institution, the European Union, and I don't believe it will ever look like the United States of America. It will be a different kind of structure, but it will be more integrated than it is now. Should we move over to questions? Let me finish this introduction off by giving you my best guess of what is going to happen. And that I'm trying to provoke questions by this statement. Many people, especially in the Anglo-Saxon press, if you read the Financial Times, you must be sure that Europe is doomed. If you read the German press, it's completely different. Many commentators believe for the last 3 years that Europe will fall apart. I don't believe that is the likely scenario. You cannot exclude that, but every rationale is there not to let it happen. Every rationale, because the alternative would be an utter disaster, not just for Europe, but everybody else outside Europe. the thing that we have to be most afraid of is coming from the historic experience. Our history books are full of momentary lapses of reason. And the question is, can we keep in such a complex structure, can we keep processes under control? Can we keep rational driving the thing? And that's where political economy and political behavior comes in as a decisive factor. And when I think about the future of Europe, I always recall Harold Macmillan, former British Prime Minister, who was asked upon his entering into office by a young journalist, "Mr. Prime Minister, what are you most afraid of?" And his answer was, "Events, dear boy, events." Thank you very much.
Well, Gordon, thank you so much. You preempted a couple of my questions. I also just want to say I get many gifts from my children. This week I got a gift of a cold, and so I'm going to apologize in advance if you hear a sniffle or an achoo through the conversation. I think the best way to tackle this, if I may, and I'm going to start sort of with a concentric circle model. So I want to start with Hungary and then build out. When you were prime minister, you were very instrumental in negotiating with the IMF to create an agreement to help Hungary through a very desperate situation in 2009 of plummeting economic growth. Hungary has had a really hard time talking to the IMF about a standby agreement or a loan facility for them. Can you give us your sense of why it's been so difficult for that process to unfold?
You mean now.
And how important is it to have the IMF to support Hungary's economic difficulties today?
Right. First of all, in general, I believe that the IMF programs are not there to solve the economic problems of a country. The IMF programs are there to win time, to provide temporary time for a government to correct its own mistakes. That's what the IMF have been invented for. But if the government doesn't want to correct its own mistakes or doesn't believe it made any mistakes, then the IMF programs cannot help. And here there is a long-standing debate between the IMF and the current government of Hungary, which is the government has sort of sent away the IMF after coming into power, and then recalled the IMF 1 year later when the markets were sort of becoming again very highly volatile for Hungary. And that was more than a year ago, and since then there is no agreement. But the IMF's presence and negotiations with Hungary have provided a safety net, temporary safety net towards markets, the belief that there will be an IMF deal. But there is no IMF deal, and the simple reason for that is the IMF, and let's not forget the IMF is coming together with the European Commission, the European Union, and they would do a joint effort like in every other country, and the ECB. So this group would want to provide money for Hungary to substantially change its economic policies. The government would want to get money in order to be able to continue its economic policies. So that's a very, 180 degrees difference of opinion or collision of opinions. And that is the main reason why I believe Hungary has not had a deal with the IMF. And as long as there is such a strong liquidity in the market, I think there is no pressure on the government to have a deal with the IMF, although one has to say that the current funding cost of the country is extremely high. The real interest rate is very, very high, which makes it, it questions the long-term sustainability of such finances. An IMF deal would not only reduce the cost of funding government in Hungary, but it would also reduce significantly the cost of
enterprise and sort of corporate and retail funding, because the country risk that is inherent in the financing cost in every loan in Hungary is built in. Mm. And an IMF deal would reduce the cost of the also for the population, the foreign currency mortgages, which was one of the major reasons behind Hungary's crisis. It would reduce funding costs for entrepreneurs, and therefore it would stimulate growth in a country which is in recession at the moment, minus 1.5% recession again.
As Prime Minister, what was the one economic issue that you were particularly concerned about? Fast forwarding today, what issue and in the future, what concerns you the most about Hungary's economic situation today? Is it the mortgage-backed, the mortgages are in Swiss franc that's causing great uncertainty? Is it a growing disparity of incomes? What are some of your concerns in 2009 and then to today?
The single biggest concern in terms of the economy, sort of narrowly focusing on the economy, is the investment rate in the economy. The most recent figures show that the investment rate is around 15-16% of the GDP. That means that it's significantly below the amortization level. So we are not even maintaining the current production base in the country, but if this would become a long-term trend, then production base would narrow, would shrink. And then that means a smaller GDP, less jobs, even if there is a positive development, prosperity in the economy, in the external environment, we could not go with it because there won't be enough investment. And that is driven by the loss of confidence in the country. Mm.
The region, and thinking about the Visegrad countries, Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, a very different economic process, though, both coming into the EU at the same time. You have Slovakia that's in the Eurozone, Poland that has thus far successfully weathered the economic crisis, although there's some warning signs. The Czech Republic that has been struggling as well, but certainly Hungary has had a more difficult time of it. How do you develop regional solidarity? And to your comment about the two-speed Europe, how does that impact the regional dynamics, the political dynamics, when the four countries that look to one another and look to help further their own interests within the EU, what happens when the economics of that group become so disparate that in some ways they can't advocate for the same policies within Brussels?
The Visegrad 4 group, which has been often underestimated
yes.
by foreign policy experts, is a group of countries who are in a similar situation. Therefore, they share a lot of common interests. And this Visegrad 4 cooperation has often been extended to include, on an ad hoc basis, other countries, Romania, Bulgaria, from the Balkans, Croatia. When we had the big energy proposal of 12 countries in early 2010, under the government that I led, we brought in 12 countries from the region, including non-EU members, to have a joint proposal how to change the EU energy policy. And it has become a very powerful lobby, in internal lobby within the EU. The European Union is a very strange phenomenon. It's not the classic geopolitical sort of balance of power type of approach. The European Union is a contractual arrangement, which is, I would say, quoting Voltaire, it's the best of possible worlds for us. For relatively small, and it's, I'm not saying it's the best world, it's the best of possible worlds. Because our countries have been exposed to huge powers in the neighborhood who've been sweeping across Central and Eastern Europe during centuries. And sheer power was the decisive factor in interest representation. Now, in the European Union, because of the mutual loyalties and to contracts, contractual loyalties, are binding the larger countries as well. Europe is working by building alliances. And if you can build a large enough alliance, you can take on larger interests as well, as we have done several times. For that, you need to be able to create good alliances. You need to be an attractive partner you need to be a successful economy, a stable society, a strong political support. But if you have that, then you can, in a relatively small countries, can achieve great results in their EU policies. So the Visegrad group is working like that kind of lobby group on many issues. The most urgent one at the moment is cohesion policy. In the multi-annual 7-year budget of the European Union, cohesion policy is one of the potential victims of the crisis-prone thinking. And these countries are teaming up to achieve more for themselves. Hungary is potentially the largest loser of the current multi-annual framework, the budget, 7-year budget. So Hungary is most interested in trying to change this position with the help of the others. But you are right, otherwise these countries are now seeming to develop in very different directions. I'm very sorry to say that my country is in recession again, right? Poland and Slovakia is growing. Czech Republic is sort of break even. So different economic policies are bringing these countries into very different directions. But looking with a longer term perspective, in 1990, the European Union, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, has started its most successful foreign policy project to date, which was the enlargement. They followed in the footsteps of Catherine the Great, who said, I cannot protect my borders but to expand them. And Europe caught the momentum and expanded its border further to the east and sort of imported or exported the European peace to that region. And then in 1990, we all thought in these countries that now we are going to step on a linear path of development from communism to a prosperous Western democracy. But it didn't work like that. Each and every country in the region had their own zigzags in non-linear periods. If you think of the Slovakia of Vladimir Mečiar in the 90s.
That was a zag.
Yeah, a long one. And then there was Czech Republic had smaller ones, but Poland had in the mid-2000s a challenge period, but now they are again on a very fast track, practically becoming one of the strongest countries in sort of the medium-sized countries in Europe. And my country, Hungary, was the leader of the first 10 years. We were really winning that period. And then for several reasons, we sort of started to drift away from the linear development. And I think today Hungary is in a zag after a long zig. And that also means that I hope that we will come out of this and return to linear upwards development.
I want to pick your brain a bit more. Watching last month's European Council meeting on the budget, on the next 7 years, not a large amount of money as far as EU terms, the budget, but the battles were fierce, particularly on the regional and cohesion funds. What are your prospects? Do you think the EU will be able to agree to a budget? Question one. And then if Hungary is the loser out of this and does not get the cohesion funds, how devastating is that to Hungary's economy, should either through the budget process or, I mean, obviously there have been some, because of breaking deficit barriers, have been, you know, restrictions on receiving future EU funds. Give us a sense of how that will impact the Hungarian economy if that were to happen.
Yes. Well, if one steps back, one step from this heated budget debate and looks at it, then it sounds a bit sort of awkward that what they are discussing about in total is 1% of the GDP of the European Union. And when they talk about how to, the different concepts are all talking about a fraction of that 1%, how that should be used or not. So in terms of the total European economy, it has relatively little, even on the international economy, relatively little impact, 1% of GDP. And the discussion whether it should be 1.05 or 1.04, the total amount is not very relevant. And that also shows a very important side factor, going back to the introductory discussion. In the US, the total centralization of at the federal level is around 25%, which has come down from higher levels of centralization of GDP. In Europe, it's 1%. So it's very difficult to have a talk about a federation or an American-style federation with only 1% used as a federal budget. Second, I'm sure there will be an agreement. There's no question. It's a combination of two things that is going on: posturing for local audiences. Europe is a good battlefield to show, to represent national interest, and that's the right thing to do. One has to represent national interest, true national interest. But there are also strategic elements to this, and that is the agricultural policy, cohesion policy, are very important elements. While 1% is a very small percentage of the total European GDP, the agricultural subsidies are very high compared to in their significance to the individual country budgets in that area. Cohesion policy is extremely important for the new countries. This is a source of investment. This is in certain countries like Hungary today, this is the prime source of government spending on investment. And if this is reduced by 20% or 30%, which is the proposal on the table, it's closer to 30, that would cut out a significant part of future investment from the country's ability to develop infrastructure, research, human investment, and things like that. So that for us, it has a tremendous importance. The 1% of the EU budget, or 1% of the EU GDP is not a lot, but for a country like Hungary, this is huge. It's around 2.5 previous years, 3% plus of our GDP per annum to for investment, and that's a lot. Given the situation that I mentioned, that our investment ratio is so low, below amortization rate, if this amount is also reduced from the EU budget, that would further hurt the country's prosperity.
Now I'm going to move out a little bit beyond Hungary and love your reflections on the role of Germany through the European debt crisis. There's been lots of commentary and criticism about Chancellor Merkel's prescription of the crisis and German reluctance perhaps to be as forthcoming on bailout funds and going through the step-by-step process, which is important, but mandating that austerity. Could you give us your reflections on the role of Germany through the crisis and the role of Germany post-crisis? I always tell audiences, I do a lot of lecturing about the debt crisis, and I said, you know, there's got to be some sort of twisted irony that the euro, in fact, was a political project to make sure that Germany would not economically dominate Europe. And 20 years later, by golly, Germany is certainly economically, has a great economic prowess in Europe after being the sick man of Europe a decade ago.
Well, let me answer this question with continuing the political economy approach that I've started. Because I think Chancellor Merkel has an extremely difficult job to do. It's easy to see a technocratically viable economic solution, economic policy solution, but you have to deliver the votes so that it becomes sustainable. And that's the job of politicians. That's what politics is about, to organize them, not to sail with the wind always in the back, sail where you want to be, and if the wind is coming from the front, then you can only go, I don't know the English term for this, tax. You have to go tax. If you look at the current results of that, then she is managing to hold it together and progressing it toward a real solution, not short-term populistic, but not long-term, not working solutions. So the political economy answer is in here is to answer. You need to answer four questions. The number one is, when there is a crisis, politicians always have to answer as the first question, who is guilty? If you don't answer that, you won't be able to go on. Now, who is guilty for what has happened? Everybody is guilty.
if you think that Germany and France together watered down the Maastricht criteria in the early 2000s, if you think of Brussels not managing properly the checks on the accounts, Greece is at fault because they joined, obviously, on false numbers, the European Union. And we could continue listing all the countries. Everybody is at fault. Now, the conclusion from that and the answer to that first question, if you need to answer who is guilty, because those should pay who are guilty. That's the populist answer if you go to the tabloids. But if everybody is guilty, then everybody will pay. Those who have money will pay in cash. Those who don't have money are paying in austerity. That's the number one. The second political economy question to ask is, can you realistically expect Germany and other northern European countries again signing a blank check without an expiry date for the total debt of Europe? I think politically you cannot expect them to do that. First of all, Germany got what it could from Europe, unification, economic dominance. Why would they do that? And it would be unjust to ask from them. So you cannot, if you cannot get the taxpayers to sign a blank check without an expiry date, then you need to ask them to sign a check with an expiry date and with guarantees that no new checks will be asked in the future. And that is what is happening in Europe. With the institutional reforms, the stricter rules, Brussels controls over budget, increased controls or influence over budgets, are all institutional guarantees, the banking union, all that is are institutional guarantees that such a profligacy cannot happen again. So Germany seems to be getting what they want. Now, the third political economy question is, can you realistically expect the citizens of Greece and Portugal and Spain, but primarily Greece, to walk into a tunnel knowing there is no light at the other end? Because this is exactly what we are asking them to do. A country at the development level of Greece, institutional development level, economic development level, can never repay a debt of not only 200%, but 120%, which is now the end target. Yeah. So there is this great book by Kenneth Rogoff. Mm. This time is different. There is a whole chapter on the relation between the quality and development of institutions and the ability of countries to manage their debt. And they show that between 1971 and 2000, I think more than 50% of the country defaults happened at a level of 60% debt to GDP or below, because the institutions in the given country were not strong enough to manage that. For example, Italy, on the other hand, is managing, or Belgium, a debt of above 100% for several years. Now, so what you need in Greece is a development of institutions and economy. But for that you need time. So one has to face that Greece at current level cannot serve more than 60 to 80% of debt. And that means a significant write-off. And now, because there are no more private creditors left at significant quantity, it will be an official creditor write-off sooner or later. One has to face reality. Otherwise, there is no solution to the crisis. And this could be done writing off conditionally for, say, 10 years conditions, and the conditions should be filled with milestones of institutional reforms, a reasonable austerity, but there would be at least a light at the end of the tunnel, that if they do all this, they will come out of the crisis. And the fourth question, to underline my optimism that I said before, is the fourth question to ask from the citizens in different countries: would anybody in Europe, outside Europe, be better off without the euro or with the euro collapsing? And the clear answer is no. There were all kinds of calculations that if Greece leaves the eurozone, they would take another hit on their GDP of 40%. There was another calculation. If Germany leaves the Eurozone, they would probably take a hit of 15 to 20%. Those numbers are numbers which are usually coming up in wars or civil wars. So that would be a disaster. If you think of, there was a, I think McKinsey probably, I don't want to misquote them, an estimate that the new Deutschmark would be appreciating by 40%.
Wow.
What would that mean for Germany's export-driven economy? So it is everybody's interest to keep this together, to keep it alive, and that is why I'm optimistic about finding a solution, save for the factors that I mentioned before about momentary lapse of reason.
Right, the country that tests your proposition, they're not in the Eurozone, but it's the UK. As Europe continues to integrate, they seem to want to go away from it. Your perspectives on the future of whether Great Britain will remain
This is a great British tradition. If you look at Winston Churchill after the Second World War had a famous speech where he was already suggesting that there should be a European federation. It's a great idea. He would love to do that, but Britain shouldn't be part of it. I think several major countries in Europe have to make a decision in the face of this crisis. France has to decide whether they are a northern country or a southern country. That's an existential decision for
and
them.
What do you think they'll choose? Which is always the right choice.
I'm optimistic. There is no other way. They will choose
to stay within par with Germany.
They will stay north, north of south.
North of south. Very good.
The UK has to decide whether they are the most Atlantic member of the European Union, or they are the narrowest Atlantic neighbor of the European Union. And that is an ongoing debate. There is a lot of populism, interesting new sort of populism, Eurosceptic populism in the UK, especially on the conservative side. I don't envy David Cameron for managing that situation. I think there's a lot of short-sightedness in that, because the UK could seriously suffer if they stay out of this integration. A second speed is probably a better solution for them, because they are clearly not ready to go into the center. And we always talk about Europe from the Eurozone perspective now, or the economic perspective now, but would it be not for an economic or currency crisis, but for example a security crisis, then Britain and France should take the lead in Europe. They have the experience, the diplomatic clout, the military clout, as it happened in the case of Libya. So Europe is not just an economic association. There are many other aspects. It will be a very difficult decision for the UK, and I believe there will be some sort of compromise at the end, but I don't know for sure.
All right, my last concentric circle, so we're going to pull way out. Talk about the role of the U.S. during the debt crisis. Mr. Geithner took many, many trips, and President Obama at the G20 meeting in Cannes last November got caught right in the middle of a major crisis of the Eurozone. Your perspective on the role of the U.S., does the U.S. even have a role in the debt crisis? Certainly our advice and counsel has not always been appreciated on the debt, because we ourselves have similar challenges, as you noted. And from Europe, how does this fiscal cliff debate look?
Everybody has their own cross. Well, I believe that the U.S. If you look into the bottom of this, then the U.S.'s problem is much smaller than Europe's problem. Europe has to manage the debt crisis and the competitiveness crisis, which was there before and would not be resolved by restoring credibility. Europe has a gross potential crisis, a problem, long term. The U.S. economy is much more flexible. It's not aging. It's young, thanks to migration as well, or immigration. And the U.S. economy has a much higher growth potential. It's a very innovative economy. So the U.S.'s problem is really the sort of a political problem which
can go wrong, but it's much easier to deal with.
The U.S. has, in dealing with crisis, it's not just the actual situation, but how much reserves in terms of measures you have if things get really tough. The U.S. has enormous reserves in terms of taxes are extremely low compared to Europe. I know it's very difficult to raise them, but when push comes to shove, simply a federal level VAT, small VAT, could solve the deficit problem and things like that. I know it's very difficult politically, but for example, in Greece, the question is not whether it's difficult politically, but there's nothing left to to save. So in this respect, the U.S. still has a lot of room to maneuver, not to mention that the U.S. dollar is printed here. So what's the role of the U.S.? I think what would be a great mutually beneficial step for both on both sides of the Atlantic is to go forward with a free trade agreement. And that would definitely add significantly to the growth of both sides over years, a well-crafted free trade agreement. That would be a major breakthrough, and it should be done relatively quickly. You cannot do them very long. And long term in this global rebalancing, I know there is the Asia pivot and everything, but with this global rebalancing in the next decade, the only long-term natural ally of the United States is Europe and the other, and vice versa. Because these societies are built practically on the same core values. You can have alliances with countries who don't share the same values, but then as history twists and turns, those differences in values will push your alliances apart. Whereas if you have similar values, you are bound to give similar answers to problems. And so I believe that Europe and the U.S. together, in the face of a major global rebalancing, will be more destined to go together than before.
Fantastic. Well, we certainly support fully a free trade agreement and hope we can get that started. The bonus question, and I just wrote a little piece on this, so I'd love your thoughts on this. On Monday, the European Union accepts the Nobel Peace Prize. And three EU leaders will be there to physically accept the prize. Martin Schulz, President of the European Parliament, of course, Herman Van Rompuy, President of the European Council, and José Manuel Barroso of the Commission. And I think about 20 EU heads of state or government are going to make their way to Oslo. David Cameron, I don't believe, will be one of those leaders that will make it there. What were your thoughts when you heard that the Nobel was being awarded? There was lots of comments in the press about that, but I would love your reflection. I mean, my own thoughts were, we should underscore that this is a peace project. The whole project was meant to prevent war, and I think that's been lost on many. But also, what's troubling me, there's a high cost to that peace, and it's very troubling when we hear populism, nationalism, extremism, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, certainly growing in Europe in pockets, exacerbated by the economic crisis. And those are very worrying trends that peace should not be taken for granted in Europe. So I'd love your reflections on that. And then, I promise, we'll get you guys into the conversation.
I believe that when I saw this piece of news that Europe got the Nobel Peace Prize, I was surprised, but I thought it's a great idea because really there's nothing comparable to the success of keeping peace in Europe during the last 60 years. And as you've said, there's a very strong tendency in politics to forget about the negative alternative compared to what we have. We got so much used to this peaceful Europe that we can't think what would happen if the European project
didn't happen. You don't win elections on saying it could have been worse. But
I think it happened here. Sorry.
Right. Usually. But it could have been worse. And last year, Angela Merkel had a very important speech. It was last year. In the Bundestag in Germany, she said, don't take it for granted that the next 60 years in Europe will be so peaceful as the last 60 years if the European project fails. That is why economists often don't understand. They talk about you should let the euro go because it's a bad project, but this would unfold the whole story. And that would have very dire consequences. So in this respect, I think that the Nobel Prize is going to the right place, but it should be going to all those leaders during the 60 years who have started the project, who have dreamed of it, who have built it, who have restarted it several times. And it's an important reminder of our societies that we should value what we have.
Wonderful. All right. Well, let's get your questions and comments. I could monopolize this conversation the whole time. We have a half an hour for these questions. If you could state your name and affiliation, and then we'll leave. Mr. Guy. Welcome. Great to see you.
Thank you, Heather. This is a great program. Thank you, Mr. Minister. Heather has asked most of my questions.
Sorry.
So I have one lingering one. Prime Minister Orbán is really not liked here. And I don't know if you've experienced that. Do you think his current activities, his current behavior, prevents investment in Hungary from the Americans? Or, as in the Czech Republic, I don't think they're looking at America anymore for investments. They're looking at Germany, Netherlands, the Danish entrepreneurs.
Well, I think it's enough to look at the facts that the investment ratio in the country is going down. Foreign direct investment levels are at early 2000 levels or late 1990 levels, which means that the country is, and this is not true for other countries, the sort of peer countries in the region are receiving substantially more investment. This part of Europe has become Europe's manufacturing belt during the last 20 years. A lot of industries have moved there. We call it nearshoring as opposed to offshoring, because they could get top quality infrastructure, top quality labor at the fraction of the Western labor cost, unit labor cost, high level productivity. So, and in this sense, Hungary is also extremely well positioned. Hungary has a high quality labor force, the best infrastructure in the region. It was ranked by Cushman and Wakefield as the third most interesting logistical talented country in Europe after Belgium and Netherlands, and Hungary doesn't have a seat. Before the crisis, we had every third new R&D jobs was created in Hungary in 2007.
My goodness.
So it was really, in this respect, it was booming, but there were many other problems with the economy in terms of macroeconomics, deficit, indebtedness, etc. But in terms of FDI, it was going well, it was creating a lot of jobs. And it was not only creating jobs, but bringing in capital and technology. The crisis has not stopped this process. To the contrary, this was the time when our government have agreed the Audi investment, the Mercedes investment, the Opel investment, so the car sector, three giant investments in the country. These are the investments which are now, the ribbons are cut by the current government. The problem is that the new investments will be missing 3 years from now. There will be no ribbons to cut. That is a big concern, and that is mostly because of the loss of confidence in the Hungarian economy, macro economy, not the basic talents of the country. But otherwise, in the region, foreign direct investment keeps flowing for a different reason than before the crisis. Before the crisis, the name of the game was expansion. And now the name of the game is concentration. And you concentrate your activities to where it's most beneficial. And that's this part of Europe. So in this respect, I'm quite optimistic that Hungary, with the proper economic policy, could attract foreign direct investment again, both from the U.S., Western Europe, or elsewhere.
Gordon, can I piggyback on that question and talk about energy and energy security in Hungary and energy diversity? A lot of the many U.S. administrations have focused on energy diversification for Central Europe. Your thoughts on the current situation about energy in Hungary?
Right. Energy security is a major issue for the countries of Central and Eastern Europe. If you look at, it's very interesting to look at the map of pipelines in Europe. And what you see in Western Europe, they are like a spaghetti. But in Central and Eastern Europe, they are just northeast, east-west lines, pipelines, and relatively scarce. This is historically so, as the Russian gas and oil was flowing. Hungary is the most exposed country in terms of natural gas. 40% of our total energy use is coming from gas, and 80% of that gas is imported. And that only can, almost everything is coming from from Russia, through one line, which is coming via the Ukraine. There is one smaller pipeline linking us to the West, but that cannot cope with Hungarian demand. So the strategy of consecutive governments, including mine, was to reduce this dependence in terms of energy security by finding an independent source and independent pipeline. This is the big debate about Nabucco, South Stream. There are some other projects, the Adriatic Trans-Adriatic Pipeline, and some other projects. The major difference between these projects is which is viability and whether they provide an alternative source or only an alternative route. Mm. South Stream is an alternative route without an alternative source. It seems it had stopped, it went in stop-go cycles. At the moment, it seems it's going ahead. Nabucco's viability was also going in stop-go cycles, depending on how much gas could flow into it, but it would be an alternative source and an alternative pipeline. So it would be more of an interest for us than South Stream, but the viability was always a big question. My conviction is that the best solution for us would be, and this is what we have set out to do in 2010, combine the Central European countries into one large project of linking ourselves up north-south, having an LNG port in Poland, which is already in construction, Świnoujście, and another point of contact in island of Krk in Croatia, at the Adriatic. And then having north-south pipelines, which would be able to deliver this gas. Hungary has huge capacities, storage capacities built under the previous government. We have the largest storage capacities in Central and Eastern Europe. This is why during the two gas crises, Hungary was able not only to maintain its gas supply domestically, but we were able to give gas to other countries in the neighboring countries. So this project is ongoing, and this is the most important and best project. Given what is happening in shale gas and LNG production and the sinking of prices, this is probably the best project. The Croatian element at the moment is missing, and that is missing to accomplish the project. The rest is in construction.
Great, thank you. Yes, any questions? I'll take the gentleman right here. Thank you.
My name is Alex Emerjan from the Austrian Embassy. Since Viktor Orban took office, he implemented a more nationalistic and less democratic domestic policy. Therefore, will the Hungarian government be an obstacle for more and stronger integration of the European Union?
We shall see. I don't think that the Hungarian government is focusing too much on the grand project of European integration. It is focusing on issues that directly mean conflict between the Hungarian government and the European level governments. So the government had serious conflicts around the media law and special transaction taxes, and there's a long list I don't want to go through. On some occasions, the European courts have decided against the Hungarian government. Some projects are pending. Very few of these debates were actually about actual national interest. There were more national interest against the European Union. These were more often domestic political interest for which there was no limitation in the country because there was a two-third majority. So the only external force was the European Union against with to whom to fight. But full stop.
Again, I'm going to piggyback. That's a great question. The EU enlargement agenda to the Western Balkans, in particular, obviously Croatia, we hope, will enter the EU next July. Hungary has always traditionally been a great supporter of continuing the Euro-Atlantic integration of the Western Balkans, but I'm not sure I've heard a lot on that subject coming from Budapest recently. Your thoughts on how the economic crisis has, if you believe, taken some of the energy and the leadership and the enthusiasm away from the EU enlargement agenda, certainly beyond even the Balkans, Turkey in particular, your comments on whither the enlargement agenda in the middle of an economic crisis?
Well, let's separate the two. Turkey is on the joining path since 1962.
It's a long path.
The Western Balkans, it is our best interest to integrate those countries into the European Union as and when they are ready. These countries in the Western Balkans are standing in a queue waiting for admission to the European Union and NATO. And my big concern, if that queue stalls and not moving forward, sooner or later those guys standing in the queue will think about joining another queue. That's a major risk in terms of strategy, security, and things like that. So I believe that it would be our interest to help them come closer and closer until they join, like Croatia did, or practically did. It will happen legally next year. The crisis is a problem for both sides. It's a problem for the European Union because it has lost, with its, all its internal problem, it is losing appetite for bringing in more problems of integration. On the other hand, the candidate countries are also suffering from the effect of the crisis, not just the economic effect, but the political effect of the crisis. So, for example, in Serbia. So it is not easy. It will be a very volatile zigzag process at best. But I think it's the best interest of the European Union to keep the hope alive and be very clear that it is worth working on this project for these countries and ultimately joining.
Great, thank you. Alex, you had a question here?
CSIS. One of the first points you mentioned was that as a result of the crisis, European governments will have to adjust to lower growth for a few years to come. I was wondering if you see that as an effect of the crisis or maybe a new normal, that European leaders and populations will just have to get used to lower GDP growth for the foreseeable future. And if that's the case, what you think they can do about it.
Right. The key driver of growth in developed economics economies is productivity. And Europe is lagging behind the US in terms of productivity. The biggest area where Europe is lagging behind is services, service sectors. US is much more developed there. Europe has accepted a set of rules for integrating its service market, but it's not developing as it should be. And thereby, Europe is losing of its GDP because of this hidden protectionism on this. So lower growth rate is not a doom. It's something you can do something about by way of structural reforms and proper economic policies. Europe's economic sort of growth potential is around 1-1.5% today, long-term potential. That is significantly below the US, not to mention more sort of emerging economies. If Europe wants to, not to maintain its role, but at least sort of not to lose its role very quickly in the world, then it should up its growth potential to well above 2%. And the countries in the Visegrad region should aim to have at least 2% higher, 2 percentage points higher growth rate than the European Union, so that there is a tangible feeling of progress. Otherwise, there will be a stabilized difference between the developed and underdeveloped part of Europe. So that's a big task for any government. Some are more successful than others.
What chills me about that prospect of fairly low or anemic economic growth for Europe for the foreseeable future is about NATO and European defense spending. I had to give a lecture this morning, and I thought back when Secretary Clinton last week gave a major speech at Brookings Institute on Europe. She talked about the free trade agreement as being an economics NATO. And I went, ooh, I don't like the economics of NATO right now as our European colleagues, the defense spending is going down precipitously, started well before the crisis, accelerated by the crisis. You know, what's your thoughts on, you can speak to sort of Hungarian defense spending, which has certainly not been robust, its contributions to NATO, but how this is an implication of a European security agenda when there's not enough will, political will, or funds to increase defense spending or to implement smart defense, to buy the right things to ensure that NATO can remain vibrant?
Yes. It's a major problem. The US is thinking about cutting its defense budget as well. And the Libya war has shown the sort of very obviously the shortcomings of the European forces in terms of running out of bombs and things like that in a relatively small war, small in terms of compared to a real big scale, big theater war. So again, I'd like to go back to what I've just said before. If a country or region's economic capability diminishes, then not soon after, its military and diplomatic influence will diminish. Europe's soft power is important, but it can only work if there are hard facts behind the soft power. Mm. In that respect, we will need to review the whole of commitments to NATO on both sides of the Atlantic. Here, Europe has significantly more to do than the US, I believe. We are going towards a very unstable world with this global rebalancing. And I would like to go back to what I've said about natural alliance based on common values. But common values should mean backing it up with money. It's not the issue of the next year, it's an issue of a project and the planning. And it will be sort of popular resentment on that will be strong in the face of the crisis. But despite the fact we need to
to do this. Many experts write that one major potential for Europe to increase its integration is to pool defense spending. Europe has the second largest army in the world by number of people after China, two point something million. It's huge. But because it's 27 different countries, it's not seen as one. This potential cannot be seen. And in that respect, it would be worth thinking about midterm, long-term, about somehow getting it closer and closer. In NATO, we have done projects. One is in Hungary, the C...
The C-17 airlifters
are based in Hungary, but it's a cooperation of 12 NATO member countries who put together their resources, pooled their resources to manage it together. It's a very successful project. These countries could not develop this capability on a standalone basis, but jointly they can do it. That's a new model for NATO to work, and it will increase efficiency. With a similar budget, you could achieve much more in the future. So I believe that is the way forward in terms of thinking, but that requires more enthusiasm for integration at the European level.
Great. Any other questions? Yes, we'll take that last one, and then we'll wrap up.
Oliver Backus, I'm an intern here at CSS as well. Excuse me. You make a very compelling case for why the continuation of the EU project is in the best interest of everyone in Europe. But I want to go back to something you said earlier in your presentation, where you mentioned that revolutions are made by those who get disappointed with the prospect of things getting worse before they get better, especially for those states or populations that have to pay for their mistakes in austerity as opposed to with actual money. What do you think the prospects are for populism and those other isms to arise maybe in the European South, people who might get disaffected with the European program and potentially give up on it?
It has happened already. If you look at the countries in more desperate situation, populism has been growing. There is a very difficult task. Somebody wrote that populism is politics without policy, and technocracy is policy without politics. And what you need is democratic politics between these two. Democratically elected, but professionally managed politics. And a lot depends on the quality of the institutions. And if there is a big division line in Europe between North and South, probably that line can be drawn around the quality of institutions. Even Italy, which has very high quality institutions, although its politics was quite of a soap opera in the last 50 years, the quality of institutions do make a difference. If you've read the recent book by Acemoglu about why nations fail, I strongly recommend it. That's a very interesting one. That will also support this fact. So I believe that populism is getting strong in countries where this disillusionment by backsliding middle classes is growing demand for simple solutions and enemies. And this we have seen in the 1930s. And those enemies, this demand will generate its supply, as you can see in the rise of extremist parties, mostly extreme right, but in some countries extreme left as well. This is a dangerous project. The European Union process, the European Union is a stabilizing factor in it, but the European Union has to renew its democratic mandate as well, because voters have found out that that their fate depends on Europe more and more and less on their national
government, but they have found it out in a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next European elections will be very difficult in 2014. There will be much more attention on Europe. Until now, there were always fought on domestic issues. Now, probably national elections will be win or lost around the European issues more and more. It will be a very difficult process to manage, and Europe has to come forward relatively quickly with viable solutions. Otherwise, the project can be put at risk.
Well, a sobering message at the very end, but I think a very critical one, and one that we need to follow very closely, particularly here in the U.S. Gordon, thank you. What an enriched discussion for the last hour and a half. Thank you for being with us, and thank you for being with us on a Friday afternoon.